Hey everybody, I'm Garrett.
And I'm Melissa.
We've been married for 8 years and have two kids, Caleb and Sadie.
Over the last few years, we have fallen in love with the scriptures and are learning how digging into God's word has helped us grow deeper with each other and those around us.
We want to be real about our lives, our struggles, and our joys.
This is Growing Deeper.
Hey guys, before we get to the podcast, just want to remind you to rate and review the podcast. That'll make sure that if somebody looks up Exodus or Ruth, that they will be able to pull up our podcast and see what we have to say on different sections of the Bible. Also, if you have any questions or comments or things that you want to share with us, you can email us now. We now have an email address of growingdeeperpodcast@gmail.com. That's growingdeeperpodcast@gmail.com. Shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you, even just saying, hey, we're listening and really appreciate it or something like that. I don't know. Shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you. Now on to the podcast.
Welcome back. We hope everybody has had a great week. We've had, I would say, a pretty good week. We went actually to the church building for service for the first time since quarantine started.
Probably March.
So that was exciting. Caleb went to the children's worship thing and he came back and he was like, that was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just really exciting to get back and just see how great of a time he had. And he was actually a little nervous going into it, which is unlike him for that kind of thing. But he did, I mean, it was just like it had been so out of our routine for a while that it was just good to kind of be back in that setting.
Well, and I think the thing that we thought we were missing most was really Caleb being in a, you know, in that worship and stuff and learning about God there with other kids. He picks up stuff so much better with other people.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, he'll come back to the car and tell me, you know, that he learned about God and stuff. And I can't remember what was the puppet thing that he was telling us about. I can't remember what it was. There's a little puppet thing that we worship, and I can't remember what the story was, but he was telling us about it.
He said something about Joseph.
Okay.
But he also, just even from at school and learning, they do some Bible study at school, and he came home and he's like, M is for Moses. And today he told me J is for Joseph and Jesus. And I was like, yeah, buddy. So that was really neat. So today we're going to get into chapter 12 of Exodus,
but it's going to be 12A.
Yeah. 12A, because it has like 50 verses.
It's a large chapter. It's got a lot of things in it.
It would definitely be our longest podcast ever if we tried to do the whole thing. And I think we would exhaust ourselves trying to do the whole thing. But before we jump into that, I did kind of want to talk about, just speaking of, I guess, parenting things. I know we have some expecting couples at church, and that's really exciting. And I like to just, we don't really know who all is listening in general to the podcast. And so parenting just seems like it obviously affects us every day as mm-hmm. parents, parenting topics. And so I just kind of wanted to share something that actually was really annoying to me the other day. So I was just kind of on my phone, spending way too much time on my phone. And I noticed this article about this 2-year-old who wasn't wearing a mask on an airplane. And the parents got kind of like into it with the flight attendant, and they ended up, I don't know if they got kicked off the plane or if they couldn't get on another flight after their layover or whatever. I made the mistake of reading the comments to this article.
You should never ever read the comments to the articles or videos. Never read the comments. The worst of humanity is in the comments.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was kind of intrigued by this because we do, Sadie is 2. And so I'm just kind of like, okay, what would it be if we were to go travel somewhere right now? What would kind of be the expectations? Or if we were to travel in a year and there's still a mask mandate, that kind of thing. So a lot of the comments were pretty positive, basically saying you can't expect a 2-year-old to keep a mask on. Because you can't. And I know from Sadie, I can't even keep a bow or a headband in her hair. She will just take it off almost immediately or within 5 minutes. And so I started seeing some negative comments, though, too, that were just kind of like, how about you just follow the rules? You should be able to get your 2-year-old to listen to you. Just absolutely nonsense things.
Which are clearly made by people that don't have children.
It would seem that way. Comments
made by people that don't have children, because obviously kids should have to listen, right? Like,
right.
That's the way the rules work.
Right. So the comment, though, that I found the most annoying and that bothered me the most, where I was like, wow, we've got to like address this on the podcast, was parenting is not hard when you actually parent. And I guess we have just had so many battles with Caleb, and I'm sure we'll have so many battles with Sadie as she gets older. She's starting to get very opinionated, and so we've had to put her in time out once. And
I put her in timeout.
Garrett put her in timeout, which I didn't think he'd ever put her in timeout. Caleb, the way he has like hard eyes,
Caleb very much enjoyed every minute of Sadie being in timeout. But I put her in timeout because I'm a huge disciplinarian. I put her in timeout for, I think she hit Caleb or something like that.
Yeah, she has started hitting and throwing things and
learning it from her brother. So it's his own fault. Yeah. It's his own fault that he got hit.
So I guess I found this so annoying because I feel like Garrett and I try so hard to parent our kids and to discipline in the right ways. And we get frustrated about it and we talk about it and we're like, why isn't this working? What should we try? How are we doing to like encourage them? Or I don't know, just balancing the positive reinforcement versus like consequences and things like that. So I just kind of wanted to share the fact that no matter, people on the internet can say parenting is not that hard if you actually parent. Parenting is hard. The kids are wired the way they are wired, and Caleb and Sadie have very different personalities, and there's nothing that we have done to control that. It's just who they are. And so for somebody to act like if you would just parent your kid, then you would never have any issue with them listening to you is just nonsense.
Right, because they're going to push boundaries. They're going to try to figure out how far can I go with this. And they're going to have expectations, and they're not going to be met because something doesn't happen the way they want it to. And they're going to have to figure out how to deal with their feelings. Mm-hmm. And so they're children. They're trying to figure out how to deal with their feelings. That means that they're not going to react the right way when they encounter those feelings. Mm-hmm. Unless that somehow they're just perfect little children. And I just don't know that that exists. They're trying to learn, just like we're trying to learn how to show them how to deal with their problems. And like Melissa said, you're balancing between how do I give positive reinforcement for the things that we want him or her to do well, and also give negative consequences and show how, listen, the things that you do, these are the things that happen because of it. And usually consequences make our lives harder too. I mean, saying you're not getting sweets tomorrow, you're not getting ice cream tomorrow, yeah, that means that we've taken something off of the table that we can use for positive reinforcement. Mm-hmm. That we can say, if you do this, then you can get that. Mm-hmm. Whenever we use consequences, that's something that we even take away our own ammunition to utilize for discipline and showing how to. It's just a complicated process. Mm-hmm. It's a complicated thing to figure out, and every kid is different. And Caleb is very different from Sadie, and our two kids are very different from everybody else's kids. Mm-hmm. And just like every human is unique, well, children are little tiny humans. So mm-hmm. it's a difficult road to walk and figure out what to do with it. So I don't want anybody to let other people get them down. Just tonight, I took Caleb to Target, and I bought the new Avengers game for PlayStation 4. So I'm gonna give it a shot. I haven't played a game in a long time, and so I think it would help. It'll kind of just be something nice to do by myself sometimes in the evenings while Melissa's watching Dancing with the Stars or.
You know, my trash TV shows, or
Married at First Sight or something, that I can go play a game and just kind of enjoy that a little bit. Quit being a nerd so much with all the books and stuff. But so anyways, I was buying that game.
One nerdy thing for another.
Yeah.
It's really
Yeah. So buying the game, and Caleb kind of got it in his head that the game was for him. And it is an Avengers game, so I can see where that would be confusing. So he's dealing with disappointment whenever I tell him, because it's 7:15 at this point, and he's like, can I play the game when I get home? And I'm like, dude, I don't know if you can actually play the game at all. I don't know what it's going to be like. I don't know how difficult it's going to be. It's probably not going to be something that you can play. I let him play the Spider-Man game from time to time.
Yeah, he just runs around
the city. Yeah, he just runs around the city.
Throws and trash cans.
Yeah, I taught him how to throw trash cans. And so he enjoys that. And so we'll see if that'll work out for the Avengers game. But I'm trying to tell him, listen, there's possibility you may not get to play this game. But he has it in his head. It is for him. And so he's dealing with disappointment right there in the in Target, and he's tired. He's, you know, it's getting close to bedtime, and Melissa wore him out today, you know, running him around the yard and stuff. So he was really, really tired. And so dealing with that disappointment, he starts pitching a fit in the middle of Target. And, you know, and me and Melissa have been really no-nonsense parents. You know, we put in time out whenever he pitches a fit. We take things away. Things like that don't go unpunished for us. They don't we don't just let them go.
Mm-hmm.
He deals with consequences every single time that happens. And yet he's still doing it right here in the middle of Target. And it's a frustrating thing, because you're like, why, you know, how do we get him to learn? But now I'm dealing with it in public. And he walked away from me, and so I'm trying to get him to come back to me. You're in the middle of public area, so I'm not going to, like, tackle him and beat him and stuff right there in
like
the middle.
You would at home.
Right, the way that I would at home. And so anyways, I get him, and I pick him up, and he's throwing, he's trying to hit me, and he's trying to bite me, and this this older lady, like, saw me. She saw that I was dealing with Caleb, and she like stopped in her tracks, turned into an aisle, and just sat there on the aisle, like, glancing at me occasionally as I'm trying to deal with my kid. And she never said anything to me. So there's a possibility I'm just totally reading into this, but it's like, you feel that judgment from everybody of like, how am I interacting? It's probably, I think there's probably parts of it of me being a man and dealing with a child. I think whenever you're a woman and dealing with a child, people for some reason expect that more in the Target, you know, in the grocery store and stuff. Like, that just seems to happen more often. But I'm sitting here just trying to discipline my child in a positive way in the middle of Target. I'm a man dealing with this small 4-year-old. And so I get a lot of negative glances as to what are you doing and things like that. And so, or at least it's perceived that way from my perspective.
And I think it's because you read comments like this where it's parenting is not that hard if you just parent. And it's like, we do that.
Yeah.
We try so hard, and yet there's still these moments that are just ridiculously tough where you're embarrassed. You don't know exactly how to handle the situation. You just want to move on and get out of the store.
You know, I'm curious, actually, in thinking about this, and this is kind of a segue to Exodus, but, you know, to say that, well, parenting's not hard if you just parent.
Mm-hmm.
The way that God looks at Israel is, this is my firstborn.
Mm-hmm.
He calls them their firstborn. His firstborn, and ultimately, the whole story is how they're continually disobedient.
And he's parenting them. And he's parenting really
them.
Well.
He's parenting them continually and being patient with them, mm-hmm. and guiding them, holding them, carrying. One of the things is, I carried you in the desert. A lot of people think of that as like this fatherly, like very soft, like your child fell asleep and you're carrying. And that's just like a very loving picture to that. But as a father, I've also experienced the carrying. Just tonight, I experienced the carrying you in the desert with the kicking and screaming and hitting and biting. And you're just trying to get them to the car so that we can go home.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way in this very story, as we progress, and I cannot wait. Personally, that's the part I'm looking forward to the most,
mm-hmm.
In this book, is getting to chapter 16, 17, once they get out into the wilderness, what happens, and reading through that together. But the kicking and the screaming of the Israelites as he carries them home, as he carries them home. And it's not... there are points where it is like a child that's fallen asleep in his father's arms and he's carrying them in the desert. But more often than not, it's the kicking and screaming.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it would be really stupid, I think, to say to God, like, listen, if you were just a good parent, your children would behave. And the fact is he is a good parent, mm-hmm. and he's patient. That's his bread and butter is being patient with his children.
Yeah.
And does he discipline harshly? Absolutely. Is that his first go-to? No, not at all. Like, that's his last resort. He does eventually have to get there, but his first response is compassion.
Yeah.
That's his very first characteristic is compassion. Like a mother loves her child. That's, when we get to that point, the word for Hebrew word for compassion, its root word is to be in the womb, something from your womb. And so the tie there is that, so whenever Exodus 34 verse 6 says that Yahweh gracious or compassionate and gracious, that word compassionate is the way that a mother loves her children. That's the compassion that's mm-hmm. there. And so that parental compassion is the very first characteristic of God. And I think that there is something there for us to consider. It's his third characteristic that he's slow to anger. Does he get angry? Yes. Does it take a while for him to get there? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're seeing in this story right now, you know, with where we are. Don't let other goobers keep you down.
Yeah, just that's a reminder for us as much as it is for anyone listening or about to be a parent. It's hard and
it's rewarding, and it's also very painful, and you wonder why you do it sometimes, and then other times even right now I'm like, man, Caleb's upstairs asleep and all I want to do is just go cuddle next to him. You know, he's just like, that's all I want to do sometimes, even though he's so hateful and mean occasion.
But those are like, if you really think about it, those moments are very small and short in comparison, but they get kind of blown up in your mind into something way more extreme than what actually happened in those few minutes. Because you were with him at Target for a little bit.
Oh, yeah. We had a great time walking around looking at costumes.
And so that's the thing, is you can't judge a child based on one incident and one time
right
at a store when most of the time things are fine.
Right.
So just a little...
And parenting's gradual. It doesn't happen...
Yeah.
Well, I hope it is.
Knock on wood.
I hope it is. That one day it'll just like click and all the work that we put into it will fall into place.
But guess what? That didn't happen by
old. But I'm hoping that doing it now and being patient with it now will pay off in the future, when it would be a lot harder to deal with. So anyways, so we're gonna jump into Exodus chapter 12 or 12a today. Where we left off in the last chapter was basically with Moses kind of, you know, storming out after telling Pharaoh what was going to happen. And we covered that this 10th plague that he tells Pharaoh is going to happen. The firstborns of Egypt are going to die. if you don't turn, if you don't change something, this is the 10th opportunity, basically. So you could say that maybe every third that he didn't really get a response because it would just happen. So at the very least, we're looking at what? This is a 7th chance. This is a 7th chance. That's amazing. Okay. Holy goodness. So 7 is a Hebrew number for completion. So this is the 7th opportunity. His opportunities have come to their completion, to turn and repent. And so Moses has offered that to him. He's not going to change. And so Moses storms out in anger. Moses doesn't seem to hold Yahweh accountable for what's about to happen. He holds Pharaoh accountable. Whatever way we can work this out, God is both sovereign over all of this, and yet also Pharaoh has complete agency in his choices. He still holds Pharaoh accountable for his choices and not changing his mind for the benefit of his people. So he storms out, and basically this is where we're going to enter into really the first set of commands that we've really come across in the Torah. Everything else has kind of been, it's all been really just straight narrative. So we've gone in the Torah, we have gone, 61 chapters? 61 chapters in the Torah before we get like some sort of set of what we would consider laws. That's how we view them. And so then it makes us question, like, how do we really read the Torah? When we say the Torah, and a lot of times we will say that that means the law, it really means, the Hebrew word really means instruction, the instruction or the teaching. What does that mean, and how do we read it? Oftentimes we look at this like it's a, like for some reason that this is just all a bunch of set of commands. Like God's given us a bunch of commands that we're supposed to follow, and they're here in this book, the Torah. But that's just not what this has been. It's been 61 chapters of narrative. And so I think we have to start changing our lenses on how we read this and why is this important. Is it for us to find a list of commands to go follow, or is it telling us a story about God's relationship with humanity? And I think it's the latter. You know, it's telling us a story. And so let's kind of read into it that way, but looking at it as a narrative as opposed to list of commands. So anyways, as we go through here, he storms out, and we now have this dialogue between Yahweh and Moses. So go ahead.
All right. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in Egypt, "This month is to be for you the first month of your year. Tell the whole community of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, each man is to take a lamb for his family, one for each household. If any household is too small for a whole lamb, they must share one with their nearest neighbor, having taken into account the number of people there are. You are to determine the amount of lamb needed in accordance with what each person will eat. The animals you choose must be year-old males without defect, and you may take them from the sheep or the goats. Take care of them until the 14th day of the month, when all the people of the community of Israel must slaughter them at twilight. Then they are to take some of the blood and put it on the sides and tops of the door frames of the houses where they eat the lambs. That same night, they are to eat the meat roasted over the fire, along with bitter herbs and bread made without yeast. Do not eat the meat raw or cooked in water, but roast it over the fire, head, legs, and inner parts. Do not leave any of it until morning. If some of it is left till morning, you must burn it. This is how you are to eat it: with your cloak tucked into your belt, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. Eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. On that same night, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn, both men and animals, and I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. The blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you. No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt."
So the very first section of this, so now all of a sudden we enter into this liturgy, or a way of it, God's giving instruction on how to celebrate something, and what is the future going to look like. And so the very first thing here is this month will be the beginning of the month. So where we are today on the calendar is we're about to enter into October. What just happened was Rosh Hashanah, which is the first day of the year on the Jewish calendar. However, and what's coming up this next week is Yom Kippur, which is the Day of Atonement, which is it occurs in the seventh month, and so there's symbology to that. Anyways, so they just had the Jewish New Year. However, I just mentioned it's actually the seventh month now. What I'm getting at is that this event, this Passover, resets everything for them on how they even view the calendar. Everything for Israel is now going to be based off of this Passover feast. This is going to be the Feast of Feasts. It's going to be the one that's going to set the tone for everything for them. It's a brand new start. And this is the only one of the feasts that it's the only one of the feasts that has really a backstory to it. And the reason for it is this is what gives them their identity. This is where they begin. And I'm going to read a little excerpt from John Salehammer's notes on this. Or not John Salehammer. This is, yes, what is his name? Little note here. It seemed like the end, but it was actually a new beginning. It had seemed as if Israel was finished. Pharaoh would never let her go, but God declares that she will look back on this moment as the beginning of her life. Even the calendar will testify to the God who makes the end into a fresh beginning. Apparent dead ends into moments of creation to look back to. Anyways, so the basis, what I'm getting at here is everything for them now is going to revolve around the Passover. If we think about it, it's almost like if we were to, whenever, you know, the Declaration of Independence was signed, if all of a sudden it was like, this is the first day of the year.
Yeah.
You know, and like everything's going to be based off of that. So that I think that's the point there is what's going on. He's resetting the calendar. Everything is now based off of the Passover. It's the biggest deal of the year. Passover is by far the biggest festival of the Jewish calendar because it gives them the identity of who they are. You have any thoughts on this?
Well, one thing that I had noticed is that when it says that basically if your house is too small for a whole lamb, go and share with somebody else, and just kind of being considerate of the number of people. And to me, I read that and I was thinking about not being wasteful. And something else that came to my mind was something Garrett and I have talked about before has just been God doesn't like kill for the sake of killing. Like everything has a purpose to it. And in this situation, it's the same. It's not like, okay, you for every household kill a lamb, even though there's only two people living in this house and the lamb could feed, I don't know, six or whatever. Mm-hmm. I have no idea what the numbers would be.
Yeah.
But the point being of just, there is, it just kind of reminded me of that, of just how God doesn't just desire to kill for the sake of killing, that there's a purpose behind these sacrifices.
Yeah.
And that also helped me through, excuse me, it helped me through this whole section, because when I read this for the first time, I think because this is not our culture, it's really hard for me to understand why all this is exactly necessary. And I don't know, that was just kind of something I struggled with as we read this, of just seeming so ritualistic when I feel like now we've tried to take things and be like, we don't need to be so ritualistic anymore. It's all, you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure. So, and one thing I want to note with this is when we, and I'll kind of come back to this whenever we get to the end, but
yeah.
This whole feast is what Jesus centers his whole his whole death around. This feast right here, it gives, not only does he give this more meaning looking backwards, he takes this and he says, this is what I'm doing. In some way, he's doing this. And so, just to kind of recap what they were supposed to do, they're supposed to take a lamb. They're going to bring a lamb into their house. And if they don't have enough people to fill themselves with, you know, to eat most of the lamb, then they were going to go to their neighbor's house. The point there being that, all of the lamb needs to be eaten. Mm-hmm. And if there's some that is left over, it's burned up, which is kind of a giving over to God. It belongs to nobody else other than God. And so that would be what the burning up would make it go ascend, to God, similar to the burnt offering that we'll see in Leviticus, but, it would be given over to God. Nobody else could have it. But anyways, the whole of the lamb was supposed to be eaten and to where it would fill up the person. So this lamb, in some way, whenever it's killed, and the people eat it, it's like they're identifying with the lamb. They're saying, you know, like, now the lamb is a part of who they are. So whatever happened to the lamb, they're saying, has happened to me. So whenever they partake of the lamb, they take and eat of the lamb, they become the lamb in some way. It's not really explained in here. And even whenever we get to Leviticus, it's not really going to explain. Atonement is something that is not really, you're not given a full-fledged theory of atonement. That's why there's been so many different theories of atonement. Mm-hmm. But in whatever way, in some way, this lamb replaces the firstborn of the house. And whenever the house partakes of the lamb and eats its body, right? And I'm using mm-hmm. language that's familiar to us, so that we can understand it.
Think about the Lord's Supper.
And think forward while reflecting backwards. In whatever way, this lamb takes the place of the people in the house and they become identified with the lamb.
Mm-hmm.
And they ingest it. It becomes part of who they are. And in some way, it takes their place. We don't really know how, mm-hmm. but it does. And so they identify with it, and you know, and they all partake of it. And also, so there's another part that you want to say something?
Well, this might be jumping ahead. I'm thinking about just this whole section seems very specific rules that are hard for us to understand. And I think sometimes when we hear, I don't know, as a parent, you give a specific rule and the kid doesn't really understand why it's there, but you have a reason behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of feel like that's what's happening here, because I was kind of confused as to, you know, why do you have to have your cloak tucked into your belt and your sandals on your feet and eating in haste?
Sure.
Why do you have to roast it? Why do you have to, you know, not boil it? Why does it have to be all of the body parts all together when it's being roasted? And to kind of spoil alert here, we're jumping a little bit ahead of what's coming next. Is there going to be run out of Egypt?
Yes.
And so this is kind of the last evening in the morning or in the middle of the night, I guess.
Yeah.
They're going to be leaving Egypt. And so all of this, eating it in haste, all of this is, you're getting ready to go. You're getting ready to leave this place behind. So you need to have your bags packed, your your good shoes on,
yeah,
and get ready to head out of town.
Yep, and that's exactly why that's there. And that's also, you know, that's why the unleavened bread would be a part of this as well, which I think is going to come in the next section.
Yeah.
All of that is for to say, be ready to go. Whenever you do this, you've stretched. Everybody is ready to run, because that's basically what they're going to do. They're going to run out of town.
Mm-hmm.
And
so I do want to highlight too, especially the roasting part, because there is a future time in, is it Deuteronomy?
Mm-hmm.
It's in Deuteronomy where the instructions are to boil it and not roast it.
Right.
And so this can become a really like, oh, is the Bible
contradicting itself?
Yeah. And that's where we have to really dig into this and dissect what is actually the command versus just what's in the context of this story here, right, where it's, you're about to leave town, you need to do all this quickly. This doesn't mean, I'm not trying to command you in such a way of, you better do this this way every time or else I'm done with you.
Right. You know? Yeah. Yeah. And so it forces us whenever we see something like that, especially, so there's 613 commands given in the Torah, traditionally counted by Jewish rabbis. 613 commands. These are listed among them. Mm-hmm. So whenever we start looking at this is law, and we're, you know, if we start looking at it like, oh, everybody was supposed to always obey these throughout all of time, mm-hmm, we run into a problem whenever we see a command that says, roast it, don't boil it, and then you get into Deuteronomy and it says, boil, don't roast it. Mm-hmm. And actually, NIV tries to alleviate that and just, I think they just say, boil it over fire or something like that for the later Deuteronomy text. Anyways, when we look at it that way, we run into problems, but that's our problem because of how we're perceiving the text, mm-hmm, as to what it's doing. And it's not doing that. It's not actually, these are commands given to this group of people at this time for a purpose.
Yeah.
And the point here is that he's telling them to do something based off of what's going to happen and right here in the near future. And even whenever we get to Deuteronomy, it's a covenant made with them, and it's not a comprehensive covenant. You know, we'll cover that as we get later into Exodus. But I think whenever we have to change our hermeneutics on how we read the Torah so that we can better understand it. And that'll help us some.
Well, I mean, and in some ways, it's good that when we start reading the Lord says, and then we're reading everything that the Lord says, that we're taking it very seriously. So yes. I don't think that there's necessarily a problem with taking everything so literally, because everybody's just trying to do their best, mm-hmm, in understanding. And I think, though, as we've read through here, you can kind of better understand that maybe this is just for this specific time, why this would be necessary.
And to show, it's this story is not meant for the Israelites of this time, of this moment. This story is meant for the Israelites that would read it later, so that they can know what happened. Like, this is for their reflection. And to say, like, oh, they ate it with their waist fastened and their sandals on their feet. Well, we eat it reclining at our table.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how awesome has God been that we can sit here, recline at our table, mm-hmm, and partake of this because we are free,
mm-hmm,
because we're a free people, as opposed to them being run out of town. And so it's to show, like, this is what God has done for you. And so they can reflect on that. So real quickly, I'm going to go back a little bit, and go back to the lamb for a second. So they would take the lamb and they would eat it, and then they would take the lamb's blood. So they would, you know, unfortunately for the lamb, they would slit its throat, they would spill the blood out into a basin, and then they would take this will come up later, a hyssop branch, which John will highlight in his gospel. Go look up hyssop in John's gospel. They would take a hyssop branch, and they would spread the blood over the doorposts. And what would happen is whenever God says, whenever I see the blood, I'll pass over it. And so in some way, the blood plays a part of this. So not only do they identify with the lamb by eating of the lamb, but somehow the blood covers them in some way that God looks at it and he sees that whatever is needed to be done has been done and he passes over. And so the blood provides some sort of protection. Also in the Torah so far, the blood has always been the place of life. So whenever Noah comes off of the ark, he is told, hey, make sure whenever you eat food, whenever you eat animals, that you don't eat it with blood still in it. Why? Because the blood belongs to me, Yahweh. So he would say, the life is in the blood, and the life belongs to me. So don't eat the blood, because the blood belongs to me. I am the controller of life. Life belongs to me. Only I give it. Only I take it. So the blood is connected to the source of life as well. So this source of life of the Lamb has been taken. It's been spread over the doorpost. Yahweh sees it and passes over them, and so they live. And so it's probably hard for us to fully grasp and understand. This is something, I think this chapter, just by itself, you could read it 50 times and maybe even think of new stuff associated with it, especially with reflection on other passages. This passage is going, you know, the imagery from it is used all throughout the Gospels. Think about, so this lamb, right at the opening, you know, of some of the Gospels, you'll see, "Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world." John the Baptist would say that in reference to Jesus. So whenever he says that, he's thinking about this. He's thinking about this lamb that takes away the sins of the world. And then we'll see in John's in all the Gospels, we'll see Jesus portrayed as the Lamb of God, who does take away the sins of the world, you know, whose blood is spilt and whose body is partaken of by his followers. All of that imagery, whenever you start reading especially the synoptic gospels of the Lord's Supper, all of this imagery starts coming out to you because they're holding this feast. That's what they're doing. In Luke, Jesus tells his disciples, "I have earnestly desire to partake of this Passover with you." And I've longed for this Passover. So he's partaking of this feast that we're reading about for the first time here. And so all of this matters to filling that out. If you don't understand this, it's going to be hard to fully grasp everything that Jesus does. So you have any other thoughts on this section?
I don't think so.
Okay. So what am I reading? I'm reading
14 through 28.
Okay. "And this day will become a memorial for you, and you will celebrate it as a religious feast for Yahweh throughout your generations. You will celebrate it as a lasting statute. You will eat unleavened bread for 7 days. Surely on the first day you shall remove yeast from your homes, because anyone who eats food with yeast from the first day until the seventh day, that person will be cut off from Israel. It will be for you on the first day a holy assembly, and on the seventh day a holy assembly. No work will be done on them. Only what is eaten by every person, it alone will be prepared for you. And you will keep the feast of unleavened bread, because on this very day I brought out your divisions from the land of Egypt, and you will keep this day for your generations as a lasting statute. On the first day, on the 14th day of the month, in the evening, you will eat unleavened bread until the evening of the 21st day of the month. For 7 days, yeast must not be found in your houses, because anyone eating food with yeast will be cut off from the community of Israel. Whether an alien or a native of the land, you will eat no food with yeast. In all of your dwellings, you will eat unleavened bread." And Moses called all the elders of Israel, and he said to them, "Select and take for yourselves sheep from your clans and slaughter the Passover sacrifice. Take a bunch of hyssop and dip it into the blood that is in the basin, and apply some of the blood that is in the basin to the lintel of the two doorposts. And you will not go out anyone from the doorway of his house until morning. And Yahweh will go through and to strike Egypt, and he will see the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts. And Yahweh will pass over the doorway and will not allow the destroyer to come into your houses to strike you. And you will keep this event as a rule for you and for your children forever. And when you come into the land that Yahweh will give to you, as he said, you will keep his religious custom. And when your children say to you, 'What is this religious custom for you?' you will say, 'It is a Passover sacrifice for Yahweh, who passed over the houses of the Israelites in Egypt when he struck Egypt.' and he delivered our houses. And the people knelt down and they worshiped. And the Israelites went and they did as Yahweh had commanded Moses and Aaron, and so they did.
Okay, so the first part of this section, I'd say, I think it's verses 14 through maybe 20, is kind of looking forward from an annual basis of how they are going to celebrate and remember what is happening at this very moment. And then we'll talk about in a minute about 21 through the rest of what Garrett read is more about, okay, now we're going back to what's happening right now.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, we've got these 7 days to eat bread made without yeast. And that seems to be incredibly important as it's repeated.
I mean, over and over. The repetition here is just like,
in the 7 days.
Yeah, seven days of eating it and the unleavened bread. I mean, basically, it's to remember the haste. So this is the way that they remember the haste of how they came out of Egypt, and that, hey, we didn't even have time for our bread to rise with yeast. We left with basically, crackers from Egypt, and that's all that we had to eat. It's a celebration of that. I mean, all of this is, God's first command, set of like liturgical commands, is a way of how to celebrate.
Mm-hmm.
What an awesome thing.
And for some reason, I think we take it kind of negatively.
I know.
Why are there so many commands? And what do you mean, don't work on the first and seventh day? Okay.
Yeah, so let's tease that out a little bit. So this is don't work. This whole story has been predicated on the idea of that Moses has made their lives horrible with bitter labor,
mm-hmm.
right? And so now all of a sudden you're transferring from one Lord to the other. You're going from, their allegiance is going to be to Yahweh. He's going to be their king, just like Pharaoh was. But he's a humble king. He's a king that gives rest.
Mm-hmm.
That says, I'm going to bring you out into the wilderness so that you can have rest.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Like he does want to be their king. He does want them to serve him, but he's doing it in a way that's not like grinding them out.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're transferring from this Pharaoh who just wears them out. And now we're seeing, he's like, I want you to not work. I want you to chill out for a little bit. You know, I actually want for you to enjoy your life.
Yeah.
In some way.
And this is actually like the more I think about this, the more relatable it is, because sometimes I feel like I'm just go,
mm-hmm.
that I almost need somebody to tell me, stop what you're doing. You need to take a break.
Yeah.
And chill out and not have to do the responsibility things for a hot minute, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's just this reflection. I mean, it's not that, like, okay, stop doing everything that's even fun. That's not meant by this. The idea of resting, to Noah, that's the word, Noah. Noah's name comes from it. Noah means to rest. Whenever God rested on the seventh day, it wasn't that he took a nap. He didn't go take a nap. He enjoyed the creation that he made.
Although that is a great option.
It is a great way to rest. He enjoyed ruling and reigning his creation, his whole kingdom that he had just made. That's what the seventh day is about. That he takes up his throne and all of the work that he's done, he now gets to enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not about just not doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's about enjoyment and enjoying that which you have worked so hard for.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wants them to reflect on that too. So yes, naps are a great way to rest and take a break. And that is a very good thing to do. but even more so, it's like, for me, it's me going for a long run on a Saturday. Mm-hmm. You know, I get kind of that 2 hours of running by myself and just reflection and that's rest. It's hard, but it's still rest for me. It's rest for my mind. It's rest for me to say, I mean, even to say, you know, thank you for everything that I've been given, that I can take this day and do this on. I mean, everybody else in this culture would look at any day not spent working, being like, dude, you're lazy. That's what Pharaoh says. You're lazy. You're stopping them from working. You know, why are you coming into my courts? And so now this guy, this God is bringing them out so that they can have rest. And then now reflect on that with Jesus, that he's talking about the Pharisees and how they've given them a heavy yoke. Mm-hmm. And it's not that he's going to remove the yoke, right? He's saying, put my yoke upon you, right? Because, you know, my yoke is easy and my burden is light. It's not that there's no burden. It's just that this idea of this release and this rest, this God who gives rest. And that's what I think Jesus is offering to his followers, especially in light of the Pharisaic heavy burden of the law, the way that even they view the Sabbath. You know, it's like it takes work to even observe the Sabbath the way that they think you should. And so that's something that he is reflecting on there. And there we see the God of rest in the person of Jesus, as he's going around Galilee. So
I think we have to address this idea of being cut off from Israel if they were to have yeast, because when I read that, it sounds really gloom and doom, hopeless.
So I did look into this.
Okay, good.
Well, before I was just kind of like, maybe we're looking at it like it is too harsh.
But is it really that
harsh?
It's
pretty harsh. Yeah, I mean, it's like a exile from the group.
Yeah.
For not following it. And it's just, I do think that it comes from this idea of like, it is a big deal that they listen to God, they obey his commands. And so if they don't do that, I mean, it's just for whatever reason, it seems to be a big deal of this yeast. And also thinking about the yeast, Jesus is going to mention the yeast of the Pharisees in his parables as well, or in his discussions.
You know, if you have any thoughts on yeast, contact us.
Yeah.
as to why that would be.
Well, I mean, it permeates. It goes throughout all the bread, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. And so it's something, previous to this, I'm not sure how it plays into the story, other than just the fact that the unleavened bread, as they leave Egypt, that didn't have a chance to rise. Why yeast would be so negative, you know, outside of that, I don't know. But it seems to permeate the whole bread. I mean, Jesus uses that both in a positive way and a negative way.
Yeah.
And so in the idea of the Pharisees, I mean, it's just like one little, you know, you got one dude that's coming in and like poisoning the whole thing.
Yeah. And I think we need to try to, I know I especially need to work on letting these negative, well, seemingly negative statements outweigh the fact that this section is about a celebration. I think that I can focus so much on the fact that, oh my goodness, you could be cut off and exiled from Israel, that I'm missing the point here of you're going to have a celebration every year. This is like Christmas.
Yeah. No, it is. I mean? This is more important than Christmas is to us.
Right.
You know, like this is way more important.
And so if I really keep perspective here and not just hone in on these small sections that are telling me the consequences of not obeying, then I can really see the goodness that God wants for us.
Yeah.
And the other thing I wanted to mention, and we'll talk about this some more as we get to the end of this section, is just the idea of this being a celebration for generations to come, and to me how that's just reflecting back to the promise of future generations, of just again saying, yeah, I know what I have promised, and there are going to be future generations of you that are going to continue to celebrate. I mean, that's almost reaffirming in and of itself, basically saying, yeah, you're going to survive out in the desert, out in the wilderness, and there are going to be future generations that are able to celebrate this.
Yeah, it is looking forward to the future to say, your kids are going to ask you about this.
Yeah, that's a message.
This is going to be a really odd thing that you're doing.
Yeah, and that's
going to be a really weird thing.
Hope in and of itself.
And that's why it's going to be impactful to your children, because they're going to look around and be like, nobody else does this.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we do this? And then you're going to have an opportunity to explain to your children, we do this because God spared us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we did this. We do this because God, God heard our cries in Egypt, and he delivered us because he cares for us. That's the story that they're going to get to tell their children. It would be almost like that. Like if only, maybe if only like 10% of the United States celebrated Christmas and put up a Christmas tree. Like, think about how odd that would be then, for somebody to bring a tree into their house and hang it up or what, you know, which let's just ignore the idea of what that even symbology came from. But like, it would be really weird to be like, why do you bring a tree into your house? And you're like, oh, okay, I can tell you a story now. And so that's the way it gets used. Like, you got these people that seem to be doing something really odd, and your children ask, what does this mean? And what it means is that God is a deliverer. God heard our cries in Egypt whenever we were bound in slavery, and he delivered us. He brought us out into the wilderness, and he delivered us to the promised land. And what he, even in future generations, the way that Jesus would be looking at it, and his followers, they're looking back with underneath the yoke of Rome and saying, you know, what is this feast for? Well, they're saying God is a deliverer. And right now we're under the slavery of Rome, but he's going to deliver us. He's going to send somebody who's going to bring us out of that slavery. And so it created a lot of problems with Rome. Every time they had a Passover, there it was high tension because this was the festival of the God who saves, of the God who redeems his people from the yoke of slavery. And so, you know, that's what's going on, and that's what's in their minds. Where that gets turned on its head is Jesus is saying, no, like, yeah, Rome stinks sometimes, but the real thing that you're under slavery to is to sin. You're under the slavery of sin, and you need to be freed from that slavery. That's the exodus that you need, is to be freed from sin and freed from the powers of darkness that rule this world. It's not just Rome. It's the things that are even behind Rome, the things that are pulling the strings and playing the song behind Rome. He's saying that we're going to deliver you. You know, I'm here to deliver you from that. And then by that, you'll be delivered from everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is the story that Jesus is telling, you know, whenever he has his Passover feast. Do you have any other thoughts on this?
Well, real quick, before we wrap it up, I guess just mentioning the fact that he will not permit the destroyer
mm-hmm.
to enter your houses. And I think we can think of that as being like a demon or something separate from God. But as we kind of looked into this word destroyer, it seems to be more of destruction by maybe angels.
Sure.
Because we did want to emphasize that this is God doing this.
He takes ownership for it.
Yeah, I mean, it's,
yeah,
you know, it's kind of like striking them, striking them down. Trying to figure out what verse that was. But
yeah, he says, anyway. I will go throughout Egypt and I will strike them.
Yeah, so... you know, the destroyer isn't like all of a sudden like Satan's and like a Satan character.
No, I don't think so.
I don't think. I think it is supposed to be like his angels.
Think about the angels of Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah.
You know, the they go and all of a sudden they deliver them, and all of a sudden Sodom and Gomorrah are wrecked.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be easy to hone in on that and be like, look, why would Yahweh do that? But mm-hmm. he's given 10 chances, mm-hmm. or seven opportunities to turn Pharaoh, yeah. and he refuses to do it. This is not on Yahweh. Yahweh is a God of justice. He's bringing justice. But juxtaposed to that justice is deliverance and redemption and salvation that he's offering. I've read two commenters that have said, and I don't know if I totally buy this based off of reading the story, but they're like, Egypt had just as much a chance to be underneath the Passover lamb as anybody else did too.
Yeah, that's good. So, I was kind of wondering about that, if they would have known.
And then there's going to be Egyptians that leave with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, well, were they underneath the Passover lamb? You don't know. Like, that's not really given to you. But what we have to understand is that God is gracious and compassionate. The third one, slow to anger. It doesn't mean he doesn't get angry. He gave Pharaoh seven chances to change his mind, and he refused to do it. He told him what would happen, and he refused to change his mind. He's slow to anger, but it doesn't mean that he doesn't get angry. But he's abounding in loyal love. And so that's all part of this. You have the justice of God, and the judgment of God is weighed and shown in the midst. Like, and in the midst of that comes the salvation of God and his compassion and his care for his people. So you can't have one without the other. In the midst of this, you have the judgment of God on one hand, and you have the mercy of God on the other.